On step one, which is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. So Susan, we're ready to hear what you have to say to us.
Hi, Ellen. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Susan Twining. Sister Stephanie asked me if I was nervous, and I said, I don't get nervous until I get up here. So now I'm nervous. I'm going to give you the basic information because that's what usually stops me being nervous. My sobriety date is July the 9th, 1978, and what that means is I will leave here tonight 42 years sober. And if I don't do something really, really stupid, tomorrow morning I'll wake up with 43 years of sobriety. And throughout this series, you're going to hear that I've made a lot of really stupid mistakes. And I'm going to tell you, most of us have. And the only one I didn't make was I didn't pick up a drink. Now, I have a sponsor, Helen Schaefer. Love the lady to death. Do I call her as often as I should? No. I only pick up the phone and call her when I'm really at that point where I can't figure out what to do next. I try to convince myself I'm going to call her every week. I'm going to call her every single week. I'm going to pick up that phone and call her, and time slips away, and it's 2-3 weeks. I've written notes to myself. I forget to look at the notes. What would I do with my girls with that? I would, you know, when they called me, I'd say, well, hello, stranger. So what does she do when I call her? She says, hello, stranger. Okay? I can't force somebody to call me. She can't force me to call her. That's just the way it goes. She's powerless over me. I'm powerless over her. We're right back to step one here, aren't we? Okay. I got sober in Reading, Pennsylvania. I did not get sober in Erie. I've made a lot of moves over my sobriety. But Reading is where it all started. I wound up in detox sometime on the night of July 8th. So sometime over the night. I don't remember when I got there. I don't remember how I got there. My first sponsor name was Audrey Hoffman. Wonderful lady. I didn't think so at first. The one thing I really wanted to bring up and talk about tonight is about step one. I spent Saturday talking to a young lady at the club. She has a sponsor. And she was talking to me about how she's having trouble understanding the powerlessness of alcohol and she doesn't get step one. And her sponsor told her she has to stay on step one until she fully understands it so they can't move on to step two. And I'm going to tell you, if my sponsor had done that to me, I would not be here today. What my sponsor did was she gave me enough of understanding of step one about the powerlessness I had over alcohol and the unmanageability of my life, because I really didn't see unmanageability in my life, and I will get into that more, that we were able to move on through the steps so that I could get to step 4 and 5 so I could dump some character defects and I could get into step 6 and 7 and I could start asking for a God to help heal me. And I could get to step 11, and I could get to step 12, and I could go back to step 1 and get a little bit more understanding about God, and about unmanageability, and about powerlessness. I know we have to have step 1 perfect. I know that's the only one we have to have an understanding of 100%. I know that's the only step we have to get 100%. But if we make people have it 100% at the very beginning, we're going to lose them. What my sponsor did with step one was, I didn't see unmanageability. I was 18 years old. And what I was hearing was, I've had DUIs. I lost my wife. I lost my house. I lost my job. I wrecked my cars. I did this. I did this. I did this. I did this. I had never had a DUI. Cops drove me home quite a few times. But I had never had a DUI. I had never lost a house. I never owned one. I had never lost a job due to my drinking. I had never totally wrecked a car. I've bumped a few. Played bumper cars quite a bit. I'd lost a few cars. I spent quite a few Sunday mornings running around looking for my car. Calling my friends going, do you remember where I lost my car last night? Sometimes people knew, sometimes they didn't. But I didn't see that as unmanageable. My other friends were doing the same thing. We would spend Sunday mornings running around looking for their cars too. Because I only drank with people who drank like me. I didn't see unmanageability. And when I got here, alcohol was still my solution to my problems. Because I started drinking because alcohol got me to where I needed to be, anybody but me. So when I got here, alcohol was still my solution. I still didn't see it as the problem. Everybody else saw it as being in my life. The only problem I saw with alcohol was that I couldn't get my head off the pillow in the morning without taking a drink. That I couldn't get through a day without taking a drink because my hands would shake. That was a problem. So if you guys could teach me how to do drink without having that be a problem, I'd be okay. But alcohol still helped me not be me, so how could it be my problem? What my sponsor did was say to me, if you can get through a year without drinking and doing it my way, the way of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't think things are better, I'll cheerfully refund all of your misery and send you back out there. And I said, I can do that. And that's what she did. And she walked me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with that kind of an understanding of step one. That's what she did for me. It wasn't a perfect understanding. It wasn't that 100% total, yes, I'm powerless over alcohol, and yes, my life is unmanageable. That wasn't it. If we're waiting for people to have that kind of understanding, we're going to lose them. I take on a lot of girls that don't have that kind of understanding, and I walk them into step two and into step three, and I get them to step four, and we dump enough garbage to help them see a little bit clearer, and I get them all the way up to where I've got them helping other people, and I take them back and we get a little bit clearer, and each time I take them through the steps they get a little bit clearer. I'm going to tell you, I sponsor 10 women. Of those 10 women, 7 of them I've been sponsoring for multiple years. And if you could see some of the women that I sponsor, and you could see how they each year they get a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better. And I love them to death, and they're not just my sponsees anymore, they're my friends too. And I'm not saying I'm the best sponsor in the world, but I like to think that I give them a chance at becoming the ladies that I call them at from the start. I don't call them pigeons. I call them ladies. They are my ladies. To go back to talk about step one, I've been keeping a notebook for years, and it's things from out of the big book, from the 12 and 12. I have a list of books that I work out of. We were talking about this at the very beginning, before the meeting started. The list of books that I use: Alcoholics Anonymous, Stools and Bottles, Little Red Book, Practice These Principles, Back to Basics, Drop the Rock, The Ripple Effect, A Program for You, Living Sober, Came to Believe, AA Comes of Age, Language of the Heart, 12 and 12, The Steps We Took by Joe McHugh, As Bill Sees It, Daily Reflections, Language of Letting Go, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, Pass It On, A New Pair of Glasses by Chuck C. That's a partial list. I can't just say I use them all for step one, but at any given time when I have a question about a step, I'll go pick those books up and I will go and read through, and I will find what I'm looking for about the steps. But I keep a file on my computer. And as I'm doing a workshop, or I'm reading in a book, and then something pops up, man, that's valuable, that step whatever. And I go to this file I keep on my computer, and I type it in on that step. And when I was telling Helen that Kevin had asked me to do this, she says, well, I did a lot of homework before I did that. And I'm like, you're trying to tell me something here, aren't you? She goes, uh-huh. So I started doing some homework. I went back and I printed out what I had written in my files. And I went back and I pulled out those books that I'd been typing this stuff in, and I reread those passages, and I did some homework, I did some studying, so that I could be clearer about what I wanted to say about what these steps mean to me. Because I live these steps. Because this isn't just something that I do. And I think that I'm on my fourth round of speakers since I started coming to this meeting. And the one common denominator I've seen is there's program A and program B. We come to AA and we get sober. We put down the drink and we get sober. And then somewhere in our sobriety, and I'm going to say with a lot of people it's around 20 years or so, we have an emotional break. And we come back to AA and we get emotional sobriety. And I'm going to tell you, for me, it was at 24 years sober. And you change up your whole life. So my first round around with sobriety was putting down the drink and getting rid of character defects. And then my second round was learning how to be emotionally sober. And that's kind of where I'm going to go with this tonight. But just to go over how I work the steps with my girls, and this is a real quick synopsis. I have them read the forewords, the doctor's opinion, Bill's stories, and then I try. Sometimes I have them read step one in the 12 and 12, and sometimes I don't. It all depends on how fried they are. Because sometimes step one in the 12 and 12 is just too complicated, and if I have them read it, it just confuses them. So that's kind of up in the air. But the directions for taking the step one are on page 30 in the second paragraph. And it says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. The following paragraphs describe unmanageability. That's exactly it. That's right there. That's step one. Period, the end. Now, things I've learned is what I have to teach them and what I have to get them to admit is that they have to have a sincere desire to stop drinking. They have to admit and believe in their innermost heart that they are powerless over alcohol. They have to see alcoholism as a fatal and incurable disease of the mind, body, and the spirit. They have to see AA as a treatment for their disease of alcoholism. They have to see alcohol as a poison. And they have to understand how alcohol affects us, which is in the doctor's opinion. Now, I give them this challenge. I have found a minimum of 17 promises in the readings for the first step, the forewords, the doctor's opinion, and Bill's story, and I challenge them to find more. So far, nobody has. Because they think, oh, they found another one, but it actually is inside and promise that I've already found. But I challenge them, and they go look. In other words, they're reading it again and again. So I'm pretty good with that. The first step prayer is I admit that I am powerless. I admit that my life is unmanageable. When I try to control it, help me this day to understand the true meaning of powerlessness. Remove from me all of my denial. Amen. And what I have the girls write is, how do I know I am powerless over alcohol, and how has my life been unmanageable? And if they don't see unmanageability, I give them examples, and I tell them what my unmanageability was. Because I say to them, I never got a DUI, but the cops drove me home all the time. I never saw that as unmanageability, but I showed them that it was. I never lost a job, but I quit a whole lot of jobs before they fired me. So I show them unmanageability in my life. I give them examples of things I never saw as unmanageable. I borrowed money from a lot of people that I never repaid. My father used to have a dish on his dresser. And every morning when he got ready to leave, he would take a $20 bill out of his wallet and he would put it in his pocket. And that's what he would buy his donut and coffee on the way to work and his lunch with. And when he came home from work that night, whatever bills and change was in his pocket, he would throw it in this dish. And then my mother was supposed to take whatever is in that dish when after he left for work and put it into this nail barrel that she had. That was their savings account. Well, I would go in and take whatever bills that were left in that dish. I never saw that as stealing. I did not see that unmanageability. Okay? So I point out to these girls, that was my unmanageability. So I show them, I tell them stories about me, and that shows them unmanageability in their lives. Through that, they can work this first step. Usually, no more than about a week with them, and they're done the first step, and I'm moving them on to two. To talk about the sobriety A and sobriety B thing, when we first do the first step, we're talking only about alcohol. We're not talking powerlessness and unmanageability about anything more than alcohol. But down the road, we have to get emotional sobriety, because we reach that point in our lives where I'm not powerless over just alcohol anymore. My alcohol's not my problem anymore. People are. Places are. Cars are. My washing machine is. Okay? My husband's work. My children work. At 24 years sober, I was married to a man who was drinking constantly. And I, in my... let's just call a spade, in my stupidity, was handing him the money to pay the bills. I can tell you the one thing he wasn't doing with the money I gave him was paying the bills. When I kicked him out, I found out that he hadn't paid the rent, the electric, the fuel oil, the car insurance. My life was falling down around my ears, and it was not his fault, it was mine. I should never have given him the money. I allowed it to happen. I set myself up. You know how hard that was for me to face? I had just started going back to meetings. I started going back to meetings on April the 14th of 2001. I had not gone to a meeting in 9 years. Because I know how to do this. I don't need meetings. I started going back to meetings. I got a sponsor, Mary Alcoholic. She became my sponsor. Started going back to meetings. I started working the steps again. We started at step one. And it wasn't step one on alcohol. It was step one on his alcoholism. I had to admit I was powerless over his alcoholism. I had to admit I was powerless over his drinking, over his behavior. I had to admit I was powerless over that. I had to admit that his behavior made my life unmanageable. And I'm going to tell you, that was a crossroads for me. Today, my four children are all grown with children of their own. And learning to say that I'm not responsible for my children's behavior was the toughest thing I had to learn. The day that I could say, they would call me up and say, Mom, I need $20 for gas. And I would say, okay, and they would come and get it. And then 2 days later, they're calling me, Mom, I need $20 for gas. I said, I just gave you $20. Well, I needed it for something else. Well, I can tell you what they needed it for, and it definitely wasn't gas in their car. It was to gas themselves up. My sponsor says to me, if they need gas for their car, tell them you'll meet them at the gas station. Terrific concept. If they called me for food, I'd say, come on over and shop in my pantry, or come over, I'll feed you. You need gas in your car, I'll meet you at the gas station. I stopped giving them money. You know what they started saying? I'll see my buddy. They didn't come over for gas for that money, burn me for gas in their car. They didn't come over for food. They didn't come over for that stuff. They stopped coming. And I'll tell you what, my kids stopped talking to me for quite a period of time. I will tell you right now, of my four children, two of them are speaking to me on a regular basis. Two of them are not. And you know what? It's okay. I'm okay with that. They call me when they want something. When they call, I'm very polite and nice. But you know, I don't sweat it anymore. They're adults. They have their issues. They're allowed to have their issues. I'm powerless over their attitudes. And these things were hard for me to admit. But I'm not going to allow them to make my life unmanageable any longer. Step one, I can work it in every avenue of my life. I was looking for it before I came tonight, and I will find it before the end of this, but I have a paper that says how to work the 12 steps in every aspect of your life. And I'm going to tell you, I have used that paper more often than not. And I got it at a women's retreat years ago. And I have used it over and over and over again on things that were very painful for me, like my children, like my ex-husband. When I decided at the age of 50 I wanted to live in my own apartment, I had never lived by myself in my own place ever in my life. What a concept. I wound up getting into an apartment about a month before my 50th birthday. I'll tell you what, I live in my own house today with my dog and my cats, and it's wonderful. I was in a wonderful relationship with a gentleman in the fellowship. We dated for 7 years. It reached a point where it wasn't working any longer. I was able to go to him and say, look, this isn't working for me. We broke up, but you know what? I talk to that gentleman every night at 8 o'clock. We are best friends today. When we broke up, it wasn't nasty. It wasn't mean. We didn't call each other's name. We didn't call each other, call the cops on each other. We broke up and it was nice because we were friends. Before anything else in our relationship, we were friends. Because I learned how to do relationships because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But we're best friends today. I've learned so much from this fellowship and from these 12 steps. But I can't say I have power over anything. This has been a really rough week. Trying to help a friend through the most difficult thing in her life and knowing that I couldn't have done nothing to change it. Some of you knew Missy, and having to stand there at her children's viewing and know that there was nothing I could do to wipe that pain out of her eyes, and there's nothing I can do to change it. And all I could say to her was, if you need me, I'm here. And telling her how much I loved her. That's powerless. You feel it to your core. But you know what? I went. I didn't want to go. I did not want to go there. I did not want to go because I knew how powerless I was going to feel. But you know what? I went anyway. I said a prayer to God. I got there in my car and I said a prayer. And I said a prayer when I put my hand on that door to open it up to walk into that place. And I said a prayer right before I walked up to her. And God gave me the strength to talk to her. And I got back to my car and I said another prayer asking God to give her the strength to get through the next day. And you know what? She's still okay today. She's not great, but she's okay. She's still alive. Because we're all powerless. The greatest thing that we have going for us is we don't have power over anything. God has the power. We just have to take the power from Him. And I have to remember that. When I came into this fellowship, I thought I was all powerful. Today I know I have no power, that God has the power, and God is in me, around me, near me. He's not out there somewhere anymore. He's here. I can't express enough how yes, I'm powerless, but I feel more powerful today than I have ever felt in my life because I know that God is with me with the power, and I just can't express it any more than that. I really don't have much more to say, so I'm going to hush up and let you guys ask some questions.
Thank you, Susan. So now we're going to open things up for questions and answers. If you're on Zoom and you have a question, go ahead and unmute yourself and speak up whenever you're ready. If you're here in the room, raise your hand and we'll bring you the microphone. So who would like to get us started?
Of course I will. Hello, Susan. Helen, alcoholic here.
Hi, Helen.
Yeah, fantastic. absolutely fantastic. I wish you'd share some of those notes with me one of these days. You know, as you look back on it now, and you mentioned it about, you know, what would an 18-year-old consider an unmanageable life? And you eventually answered that. Well, that was my first question. But if you'd like to go into that anymore, I'll listen. And then I'm not done, so.
The unmanageability wound up being the fact that the cops drove me home all the time. One of the big ones was, I just shared this story the other day. Where we lived was on a farm, and there was a pond at the neighbor's, and it was, the road was banked, and you had to be going the exact right speed, or you would put the car in the pond. Okay, so my dad's Cadillac would slide into that pond greater than any car. So my dad put the car in the pond. Then I put the car in the pond. Well, my dad put the car in three times. I only put it in twice. But what I learned was, if I went around on Route 73 and came in the back way on Deterk Road, you wouldn't put the car in the pond. So I didn't put it in three times because I learned to go the other way. So was that unmanageability, or was that just me being a smartass?
Number two.
Next question.
Well, and this is a real easy one. When did you come to Erie? I didn't realize that you hadn't gotten sober here.
I came to Erie. I moved to Erie in 1994. I started going to meetings in Erie regularly in 2001.
Okay. One final question, and I'll let you go off the hook. Are you still stealing people's blood?
No.
Okay. Thank you. I will explain that. You were a phlebotomist, right?
Yes.
That was going to be my first question then. Like, what was that all about? But I'm Patrick. I'm an alcoholic.
Patrick.
I've heard you're not the first person with decades of sobriety that I've heard from, not in this meeting, in other meetings too, who at some point stopped going to meetings but remained sober. What, from your experience, what is the thinking that leads up to that?
You get a life, you have the kids, and you're busy. I mean, I was young. I was like 20, I was like 25, 26, and I had four kids, and we had moved to Georgia, and meetings in Georgia are strange. That's the only way to say it. And I didn't like them, and it's like, I know what to do. I don't really need to go to meetings, and I couldn't find a sponsor down there I liked, so I was kind of using my one back in Reading and in Philly, and so the mindset was, I know what to do. But what happens is you stop going to meetings, you stop getting that reminder of, I got to call my sponsor, I got to talk to God, I got to work the steps. So you stop doing anything. So you're kind of on a dry drunk.
So it's not a good idea.
No, it is not a good idea at all.
Okay. That's what I wanted to clear up.
No, you go into a dry drunk is okay. What you do. You go into a dry drunk and you're miserable. I was very lucky that I didn't drink. Okay, I'm lucky that I didn't drink. It was God's will that I did not drink. How's that?
Thank you. Oh, we've got a couple hands here.
Hi, Susan. I'm Leslie, alcoholic, and thank you so much for speaking. But there's something I still, and maybe I missed this or I didn't understand it. I understand you were 18 years old and didn't have a lot of yets, but somehow I didn't quite get, how did you end up in the rooms after all?
I had three suicide attempts in 3 weeks. I wound up in a mental ward at Hammett Hospital, no less. And my father was told that I would have to be seeing a counselor. And when he took me back to Reading, he gave me the counselor's name, and that counselor's name was Joey. And when I went to see him, he was the first person that asked me how much I drank. And so he kept telling me, I have these friends I want you to meet. And I was going to see him like 2-3 times a week, and every time he would question me about my drinking, and he kept saying, I have these friends I want you to meet. So I did not share this, by the way. But I went out to celebrate my 18th birthday on June 26th. I went to celebrate my 18th birthday, and sometime on July 8th, I called him, because I don't remember anything from June 26th to July 8th. I have no recollection of where I was, what I was doing, nothing. I have no recollection of that 2 weeks. But I called him and said, you know those friends you wanted me to meet? I'm ready to meet your friends. And he took me to detox. It turns out he was in the fellowship. And that I wound up in Reading Detox on July the 8th, and I woke up there July the 9th. So that's how I wound up in the fellowship.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm an alcoholic. So you talked about some promises, I think, in a doctor's opinion, and or whatever it was, 17 of them or whatever it was. So I was wondering if you could give me a couple examples of what you're talking about.
Well, the very first one that I can quote right off, we have Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's see. Let me find it. Gotta find it now. Okay, I'm at the doctor's opinion. That's not where I want to be. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. That's the first promise in the book. You can read the book and you can come up with promise after promise after promise. In the doctor's opinion, they believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. I mean, just read it, and it's just, there are promises everywhere. It tells you that they do recover. We have recovered. Have a psychic change. Every time you pick up the book, you're going to find a promise. I swear to God, you're going to find hundreds and hundreds of promises in this book. Read it, cover to cover. You'll find them. If you don't find them, you're not reading it. Don't use it as a coaster. Open it, read it, and highlight it. Okay, I'm going to tell you. This is my 8th big book.
Where did you get one?
See me, I have one in my trunk.
That was good.
You know, every time I go to a meeting and they're giving away books, you get a ticket for a book, and they say, well, what do you want? I say, give me a big book. And they all look at me like, huh? Give me a big book. I throw it in my trunk. And then I meet a newcomer. They need a big book. I got one. And my home group, we give away big books. We just bought a case of big books. We're going to be giving them away. We give them to newcomers who don't have one. Okay. I love giving away big books.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, Susan. My name is Elijah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Elijah.
I want to thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope on step one. You know, I can remember when I first came in the program at the age of 16. So you got it good because you came in at 18, but I came as a young boy. And I remember, like, the first sponsor that I got, he put me right on the first step. And you know, I had like this power control. You know, I didn't want to be powerless. I already knew my life was unmanageable because I made it there, you know. And like now in the here and now, when I look at it now, I understand why my sponsor said that the first step is a valuable step and it's very important. And I got a lot out of that. And, you know, I thank you for sharing that. I told you I was coming. Susan's like my spiritual mother. And I, you know, I go to her when I need some answers. And, you know, I just love Susan. Thanks, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Elijah.
Hi, Susan. I'm Bridget. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bridget.
Hi. You know, coming in at 18 and staying, what do you think kept you when you came into the rooms? Like, I'm imagining that everybody was older than you. So,
right? They were really 16, old.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and I think it would have to be in relation to your age. They seemed old to you. So what kept you there that you didn't wander off because you hadn't even turned 21 yet?
A group of old-timers that basically stuck me in their hip pocket, and they drug me around, basically. They stuck me in their hip pocket and drug me around, and then they basically made decisions for me. They got me into a rehab. They got me into a halfway house. And then I did start meeting younger people once I got through the halfway house. And when I was done at the halfway house, I decided to stay in the Philly area, and there were younger people there. But no, basically it was Audrey. There were very few women in the fellowship in Reading at that time. But Audrey to me was old. She was 35. And she was married with kids. And I thought, I have no way I would have anything in common with this woman. But, you know, I mean, she died shortly after I started coming to meetings in Erie. Yeah. She died. And it rocked my world. But I loved that woman so much. Mm-hmm. But I hated her at first. Mm-hmm. But she and it was Charlie Gring. And I can't remember Ed's last name, and Johnny Black. But, like, my phone would ring on Saturday morning, and it would be Johnny Black, and he would say, "Be ready." That's all he would say, "Be ready." And I would hurry up and get dressed and run downstairs, and I would wait, okay? And he would pick me up, and he would take me out to breakfast, and we would go to a meeting. And there we would meet up with either Audrey or Johnny or Charlie or Ed, and they would take me out to lunch, and we would go to another meeting. And they would drop me off at my house at 2:01. Okay, but they would have taken me out to breakfast, out to lunch, out to a snack, out to dinner, out to pie after the meet, you know, and we would go to all these meetings, okay, and I had a blast with them. But literally, we would get in the car and drive for 2 hours to go to an evening meeting someplace on a Sunday. Every Sunday, we went to Chit Chat Farms, and we sat there all day, and they would buy me dinner. You could buy dinner for $3 at Chit Chat Farms every Sunday, and we would sit there and talk to the patients. Okay, they kept me in their hip pockets mm-hmm. for probably the first 3 years.
Well, thank you for telling me that. And I also, you know, I'm kind of surmising that food was an element to being able to keep you around, too. That they were taking good care of you.
So they'd say, "You want to go for ice cream?" And I'd go, "I don't have any money." And they said, "We didn't ask you that."
That's great. Oh, well, that's wonderful. Thank you, Susan.
Who else has a question? Anyone else on Zoom?
I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, Amy. Hi. So I'm wondering if, you know, after going through the steps so many times, like yourself and with other people, do you find it easier to recognize other things that might be unmanageable in your life or that you're powerless over faster? Or are you still, like, really hard-headed and stubborn and, like, just just keep, you know, doing the same thing over and over? And if so, do you do like an informal kind of step one with yourself, or how do you address that?
I still get surprised. Like, I'll be doing the steps with someone else, and they'll say something, and I'll be like, crap, I need to look at that on myself, you know? I mean, because I won't have looked at something, and it just, it doesn't occur to me. It's like on the character defects, you know, somebody will say something, and I'll be like, well, darn, you know, I do that too, you know? So, yeah, I get surprised on the unmanageability of something. It happens. It's like listening to someone's lead and hearing them talk about something they did and saying, oh man, I forgot I did that. So unmanageability, sure, it crops up when I'm doing steps with someone else. It's one of the reasons why I like doing step work with girls, because it keeps me growing. I'll do the steps over and over again with different people. I learned stuff when I was running the steps with you. So, you know that, because I looked at you one day and said, crap, Amy, you made me learn something. So, thank you.
Anyone else? Kevin's
got one.
Gotta get one in, Kevin.
Susan, thank you very, very much. This has been a real pleasure tonight. You mentioned previously about fellowship was really important for you in your early sobriety. When you're sponsoring women today, your ladies, do you encourage them to do the same?
Yes, definitely. My girls refer to this to each other as sisters. And I encourage them to fellowship together, and I encourage them to get each other's phone numbers, and...
Perfect.
Well, they're a family, you know, because that was what was encouraged when I was growing up in early sobriety, to fellowship with my sisters in sobriety. So I do encourage my girls to do it.
That's perfect, because I do that with the guys, so thanks for the reinforcement.
All right. Well, I think that's it. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.